Welcome to the fourth annual Radio Free Nintendo panel, or as we are calling it this year, Super Radio Free Nintendo Live Panel, You and Me. I forgot the 64. Thank you very much for coming, everyone, and I'm going to introduce the panel real quick. First off, I want to say our friend Jared is over there running the video for you. We wanted to add a more visual element this year, so Jared is going to be queuing up videos on the fly. And he doesn't necessarily know all the games we're going to talk about. And he definitely, for Q&A, he definitely doesn't know. So he's going to be trying to keep up and hopefully give you something.
So mention the most random games you can, or potentially ones with offensive video. Jared doesn't have any idea.
Yeah, Choaniki. Let's get it out there for the kids and audience. Yeah.
And Jared is still keeping that weight off. Still eating those Subway sandwiches.
Yeah, that's right.
Good.
So, over here on the panel, we have at the end my old buddy James Jones.
Good morning.
Good morning, James.
That'll be the least offensive thing I say today, so we're good.
Yeah. James and I have been doing the podcast together for over 5 years.
Oh.
I know. And James has been to all these panels. Next to him is Guillaume Veillette.
Hi. That's the easiest clap I've ever had.
Guillaume made
self-affirming.
Guillaume made his debut with us last year on the panel, and since then he has become the editor of our podcast. It's the first time in 4 years that we've ever had the active editor of the show on the panel with us. So we're very happy to have Guillaume back, of course. Next to him, substituting for John Lindemann, who just moved, unfortunately, across the country, so he couldn't be here this week, we have an excellent replacement, Mr. Nate Andrews.
I'm doing my best. Doing my best John Lindemann cosplay today. So.
Yeah. Where's your bald cap? Forgot the bald cap back at the hotel.
You forgot 30 years of age, too.
I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and next to me is our very special guest, an old friend of the show, Mr. Chris Kohler.
Hi. I think you've asked me to be on this like 50 times, and I always can't do it.
We got lucky with the schedule this year. I really appreciate you being here. Of course, I'm sure most of you know Chris. He's on every panel at PAX.
Yep.
And he's also written an excellent book about the rise of Nintendo in Japan called Powered Up. And also, just if you need more credibility for this man, a few weeks ago, Chris hosted a one-man, 25-minute podcast about how Nintendo is not doomed. And let me tell you, doing a one-man podcast is really hard to do, and he knocked it out of the park. So
thank you.
Couldn't have anyone better up here with us.
Oh, you could.
In fact, we can go leave now, actually.
Yeah.
We're good.
Yeah. So Chris will be doing the rest of the panel alone. I didn't tell him about it.
Let me tell you guys about Nintendo. Where do I start?
We're about to get into some feature topics that we've lined up, but I want to remind everybody, Q&A, listener mail, is a part of our weekly show on the podcast every time, and about half of the show, we're hoping half the panel here is going to be Q&A, so I hope all of you have some really fun comments and questions about Nintendo. We've always had really, really good participation in past years, and be thinking about something that you might want to talk about or ask about, because we will devote a lot of time to that. So first up, as a warm-up, I have a question for the panel. What is one of your favorite Nintendo games that you think most people probably haven't played? Let's start with James down at the end.
I could start at the end.
He has.
So I actually brought my game because that was part of the directive, but nobody else did.
I said if possible.
If possible, yeah. Well, I didn't actually. So what I have here is the DS copy of Lufia Rise of the Sinestrals, which I hate. Because it ruined my favorite Super Nintendo game, Lufia 2. And it's a DS remake that Natsume put out that's... Oof. But the reason I enjoy that game is it's the first JRPG I played that had like real dungeon puzzles. And I don't mean the kind like the Tales games have where you shoot stuff with a ring and a door open. So they're really somewhat complicated level exploration puzzles. And it was just a really nice feel to the game that all around it looked nice, it played well, and it was kind of missed under the wave of Super Nintendo RPGs that came out in that era.
It's never been re-released on anything.
Well, it's been re-released on a DS game, but it's been. I just chucked that over my head, so that's probably not a high praise.
It's been remade and mangled, but it hasn't been re-released in the original form, unfortunately.
Yes.
So hopefully one day Lufia 2 will come. Lufia 1 is also very good, but not much easier to find.
I actually just finished my Lufia collection.
Nice.
All the Lufias.
What was the last one you got?
The last one that I got was actually that DS game.
Is there?
Oh, good. Yeah. It's like $3 on their website right now, and I think you get like a stuffed sheep with it.
Right. Yeah.
Is Lufia 3 like a Saturn game or something?
No,
like
there's
that?
So it's Lufia 1 and 2 for Super Nintendo, and then there was a Game Boy Color one called, I think, The Ruins of Lore.
Yes.
And then there was a Game Boy Advance one. No, sorry. One of them was called The Legend Returns, and one of them was called Ruins of Lore. So there's Game Boy Color, Game Boy Advance, DS, and then 2 on Super Nintendo.
Legend Returns means that we forgot to make games in this franchise for like 10 years.
Mm.
Okay, so moving on to Guillaume. What's one of your favorite obscure Nintendo games?
Yeah, well, back in the day, I lucked out and blind bought a copy of Demon's Crest. And I had played Gargoyle's Quest on the Game Boy and really enjoyed it. And my first Super Nintendo game was Super Metroid. But I kind of deprived myself of... You know, the experience of finding everything by myself because I just
playing good games.
Because I had like a magazine and the maps, but Demon's Crest has tons of secrets, and I actually found everything by myself. You know, 100%, and it was a glorious experience.
That's a really tough game too.
It is
really, really hard.
And if anyone likes Mega Man X, it's kind of slower paced version of that. Mm-hmm. With really dark graphics, really cool, really good music, of course. It's Capcom. And, yeah, like, the secrets are really, really well hidden. You have to really pay attention to everything in the background to try to find these hidden passages. And the first time that you beat the game, you don't even explore half the levels, and you're like, what? After 2 hours, it's just over. And but, of course, it's not. Like, you can... If you read the manual, you realize, well, I haven't picked up half of the power-ups. And, yeah, like, you'll have to explore every nook and cranny of every stage, and it's fantastic.
And it's a spinoff of the Ghosts and Goblins series. If you've ever played Ghosts and Goblins, you know you have to play through the whole game twice. In this case, it's actually something you should look forward to because there's stuff you haven't seen.
Yeah, and it's not as hard as Ghouls and Ghosts or...
It's slightly less hard, maybe.
Yeah, and you're playing as the bastard, little red demon.
Yeah.
Red Aramor. Yes.
Yes.
Except he's weak.
Get to play against the nastiest enemy in the whole game.
Yeah.
It's really fun. I mean, you can hover, you can stick to walls, you can breathe fire, and then he also transforms into 3 or 4 different forms, basically, and they all have totally unique power sets. So there's just, if you like platformers and gameplay mechanics, there's so much there. And again, Demon's Crest is hard to find nowadays.
Unfortunately, and I think it's hard to emulate as well, or maybe not anymore, last time I checked. But we don't recommend emulation.
I think the guy who did the emulator, Beast Nest, just hit 100% compatibility with everything now.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was his like passion project.
Yeah. Okay, so Nate's up next. What do you have, Nate?
Well, my hotel room this weekend is number 215, which is kind of appropriate because my game is the sequel to Hotel Dusk. Mm. That is The Last Window, Secret of Cape West, which... Yeah, thanks.
Hey,
the one
strong
guy who
applause.
Bought it. Yeah.
He doesn't. I mean, he only Nate clapped his hands twice for it, too. It's like, I guess I like it. I don't know. I'm just happy to be here.
Very passively.
The sequel that no one bought to a game that no one bought. Mm. Which makes sense because it's pretty much the same thing. It's kind of the modern noir story with it heavily based on conversation, which is the part that I appreciate most, that it keeps. Yeah, you can see up there.
And it's a point and click, right? I mean, it's a point and click, like find items, use items, you know,
unapologetically
adventure.
Almost, because nothing about it is convenient or
right.
You know, intuitive. It's very obtuse, and it doesn't apologize for that.
It looks like they didn't even finish drawing the game.
Like
they just quit halfway through and said, we're done.
If that had been the only part of the game, going through every conversation and dialogue choice, I would be fine with that. I think it's almost enough to support an entire game.
I think those animations are really cool, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... Okay, so I'll go next. And my game is a game we actually talked about last week on the podcast, but I felt it should get a little more attention, and that is one of my favorite NES games, Crystalis.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Ease. I was going to come over the table.
No, although I think Crystalis might have been influenced by Ease, as we talked about on the retroactive feature. It is a sort of Zelda-ish game. It's sort of from a top-down perspective. It's probably a little more fast-paced than Zelda. It's definitely got more RPG elements than Zelda, maybe even more than Zelda 2. Yeah, there you go. The combat is really interesting. You can sort of stab at the enemies just like that, or you can also hold down the button and your sword will charge up, and then it generates a projectile when you let it go.
She's so fast.
Is that the normal speed?
Yes.
She's so fast.
Yeah. So it's a really fast-paced game. It is very challenging, but it's just... okay.
This is a far step from Hotel Dusk, by the way.
This is a speed run, right?
That might be slightly faster.
This might be a tool assisted.
This is definitely a speed run.
What is this person
You're not
doing?
Supposed to be able to go up that ice I without us.
Suck glitches.
Well, that's some special
boots. Jared, you found a video where they're not actually playing the game right.
Right. That's cool though.
Anyway, Chrysalis is wonderful. There is a remake of it on Game Boy Color. Mm. I don't necessarily recommend that you play that version, but if it's the only one you can find. Do that. The NES version is far superior.
And if there are Miyazaki fans, like, this is not an official Miyazaki game, but it was kind of inspired by Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind. If you look at the original text in Japanese, like...
Are you serious?
One of the towns is called, like, the Valley of the Wind. And
wow.
There are similar... points, story points in there as well.
Guillaume had the handheld mic, he could drop it now and walk out.
Yeah. My mind is blown. I've never heard that before.
I do, so I can't.
That's awesome. So, Chris Kohler, what is your favorite obscure game?
So, I did bring the game, and I guess I misread the question, because this is not so much one of my favorite games as a good game that you wouldn't ordinarily think was, and that is actually made by Nintendo. So, I brought it. It's actually, it's Hello Kitty World.
Oh my God!
For the Famicom,
and this
Jared. It was published by Sanrio, but what a lot of people don't know about this is it was actually made by Nintendo. And in fact, if you look at the actual game itself, or if you play it, you would notice from all the way back there that it's actually it's Balloon Kid. It's the sequel to Balloon Fight. Yeah, so if we can get into some gameplay here.
Jared is on the ones and twos.
After all the Hello Kitty stuff, you realize it's Balloon Trip. So this is actually the secret sequel to Balloon Fight. And this game with these levels basically was released in the U.S. For the Game Boy as Balloon Kid.
Yeah, I saw the similarity.
So there she's pumping up the balloons. Yeah,
and, this is a lot of second favorite game.
And so on the back it says that it was made by Mario Company. That's who it says was made this, which must be like a shell company that Nintendo set up. But the music in this is the same music in Balloon Kid. It's by Hip Tanaka.
So it's actually
great music.
Yeah.
There you go. So here's – and it's fun. I mean it's Balloon Trip. So here's a secret Nintendo game you didn't even know was made by Nintendo.
That's really cool. So Balloon Kid is a Game Boy game in black and white. So,
yep.
I mean, this looks... I mean, it's recognizable as being almost identical in terms of gameplay, but the graphics are so different.
Right.
It actually looks really nice for an NES game.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. So the next topic, Guillaume suggested this. It's a what-if scenario. What if the Nintendo PlayStation was actually released? Now, for a little bit of background, some of you may not be familiar with all the details. We happen to have an expert here, and Chris, I was hoping you could give a very quick explanation of the situation with the Nintendo PlayStation.
Sure. So Nintendo originally had kind of partnered with Sony. Sony did the sound chip in the Super Nintendo, so they were like a hardware partner of Nintendo's, and Sony wanted to break into video games, and since they were kind of amicable, Nintendo and Sony had drafted a deal, basically, to... Nintendo wanted to do a CD-ROM system to compete with the Sega CD and the TurboGrafx CD. Yeah. And they contracted Sony to do it. And so Sony and Nintendo showed off, like there's pictures of this prototype, and it was called the Nintendo PlayStation. So the original PlayStation was a CD-ROM drive there's your Super Nintendo controller, your cartridges would plug in at the top, and the CD-ROM drive. And so this was actually going to happen. My understanding of it is that Nintendo, they kind of reconsidered the deal. They were like, we've given too much away to Sony in this deal, because I think that Sony would have had the rights to just make CD-ROM games and sell CD-ROM games for this hybrid system without having to kind of like go through Nintendo.
It's very telling if you look at the picture there that you can't actually see any Nintendo logos on it. It's all Sony.
Right. And so what ended up happening was Nintendo backed out of the deal. This They did it in a very public sort of way, which caused a lot of embarrassment to Sony, so they went their own way with PlayStation at that point.
Yeah. And Chris, do you have any ideas on this, or do you want to wait to come back around?
Everything that we know right now about the video game industry would be completely entirely different. Not necessarily saying that Nintendo and Sony... I mean, again, this doesn't mean that Nintendo and Sony would have merged, you know, but it means that for the time span of the PlayStation generation, they would have essentially been partners. And since that was what flipped the video game industry on its head and caused so many massive, earth-shaking changes, it's just impossible to say what would have happened. But but everything would be different.
But was that hardware significantly more powerful than the current Super Nintendo models?
No, and that's one of the reasons why Nintendo ended up kind of pulling out of this idea is because they realized that... The loading times for a 16-bit CD-ROM system were just not something that they were very comfortable with, and that it didn't really... It gave you more storage, it let you do a couple more interesting things, but it wasn't enough of a bump. They experimented with putting a 32-bit processor in the CD-ROM drive, and I believe this would have been a 32-bit system, essentially. And that would have given it a bump, but then they realized that it's just the processor, not the medium. Now, of course, not going with CDs for the Nintendo 64 was what, you know, ultimately sunk Nintendo in that next console war.
Yeah. I think this is really interesting because if you think about it, this was not all that innovative of a concept back then. There was a lot of ground already paved by the TurboGrafx and by the Sega CD. And
PC
by the
Engine, please.
I played Sewer Shark yesterday.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
That's not ground being paved.
And there were hybrids. There was the Turbo Duo, which was a hybrid like this. There was the JVC XI and the Sega CDX, which were hybrids.
And to get at what Chris pointed out, I think what you see from the CD-enabled 16-bit systems of the early 90s and even the mid-90s is that the CD was way more than anyone needed. In other words, the things that were holding those systems back from sort of making a big technology leap to the next step were not storage. Storage was not really the main problem there. Mm-hmm. And access speed, actually, I think, was a benefit that they had of the existing technology that they didn't totally realize.
Oh, why? Why?
Now we're looking at Sewer Shark for some reason.
This is not the Sega CD version either. I mean, the Sega CD version, it's like a quarter of the screen and it's like five colors. You know?
It's actually in the retro game room. You can go play it. Yeah. I would advise strongly against it, but you can.
What really caused it, though, was the cost of production of video game cartridges. The amount of money, if you were a third party, that you had to pay to Nintendo to make these things was so high. And Sony comes in and says, print games on discs, which will cost you like $1 to make instead of like $20 to $30 just to make the cartridge and get it. And that just caused a mass exodus of third-party publishers. There was it's like Sony is just like, here, why don't you like not, you know, gamble all of your money on making these massive productions of cartridges and just make discs, which we will print like almost just in time for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Johnny said that like the storage on the disc for a 16-bit game was way more than anyone needed, but at least one player in the industry wanted that, and it was Squaresoft. And actually, Secret of Mana would have made more sense if the Nintendo PlayStation had been released, because Squaresoft wanted to release it on a CD. Like, it was originally supposed to come out for the Nintendo PlayStation, and then they had to make major changes and cut away some chapters of the story to try to make it fit on a cartridge.
Crisscross Make My Video also needs that CD, just out of curiosity. To move towards the question from my standpoint, I'm not sure it would have changed things, but I still get the impression that Sony more or less wanted to be in the industry as the hardware manufacturer, because that's where you make your money on the license fees.
Right. I'm mostly curious, and of course, you know, there's no way we can know, but like what Sony's intentions might have been, even if they had partnered with Nintendo in this way, like what they might have gotten out of it and what, you know, they would have decided to do even after that.
You can imagine, with the roles being what they were in the mid-90s, they might have been looking for some kind of takeover situation or a buyout, you know, depending on how things went. I'm actually really glad that the Nintendo PlayStation didn't happen, even as a Nintendo fan, because I think what this would have done is actually kind of slow down the progression of the entire industry. I don't think Super Nintendo would have benefited very much from having this. And I think by Sony having to split off and go their own way and fill in all the other pieces of the system that Nintendo would have provided in the Nintendo PlayStation, it forced Sony to move into an actual new sort of generation of hardware that would not have existed if they had stuck with this add-on thing. And also, if you look at the history of add-ons, they're typically not that successful. So I think this probably would have been more successful than Sega CD, but, I mean, relatively speaking, it wouldn't have been earth-shattering, most likely, and it would have slowed down the development of things like the N64 and the PlayStation, and ultimately probably would have been bad for the whole industry.
It would have been great for the Sega Saturn.
And I also think, and of course I'm a huge Nintendo 64 fan as well, but I think the struggles that Nintendo went through in that hardware generation ultimately are good for the company and good for the games that they made, and they're good for us. So I think the lessons that they learned from going through that, you know, made GameCube a lot better and everything after that. So, you know, ultimately I'm glad the way things turned out, but I mean, Chris is right. The repercussions of this, you know, if Sony hadn't become their own platform holder, if Nintendo maybe had delayed the N64 coming out a couple years, it might have turned out to be a completely different thing. All right, so let's move on to the next one. This is also a what if, also posed by Guillaume. Maybe a little harder to get your head around. So, Guillaume, I want you to start with this one. It's what if Nintendo of America had passed on releasing Pokemon in 1998? Okay. Pokemon was a few years old in Japan at the time.
96.
Had been very popular in Japan, but that was also predicated on the anime series and trading cards and a lot of other things that hadn't really been done in that kind of cross-media promotion in America before. This was very pioneering for Nintendo of America to do that kind of thing here. And I would imagine there were board meetings where they discussed maybe let's just not bother, it'll never work. So this is really, really interesting. So Guillaume, why don't you kick it off?
Well, I'm kind of wondering if some of the ideas that Nintendo, like other ideas that Nintendo had in Japan, would have stayed in Japan. Like I kind of wonder if connectivity would have happened, because you know I think that the transfer pack for the N64 was very much designed, you know, to try to get some sort of synergy between their Game Boy and the N64. And if Pokemon hadn't happened, then, you know, like the transfer pack probably would have stayed in Japan as well.
That would have been such a tragedy.
I know.
I would not have been able to do only Pokemon-related things on my N64.
I transfer my data for Mario Golf. But yeah, and then, you know, like I think that the transfer pack was basically the ancestor of connectivity, and then you wouldn't have had
four games.
Well, yeah, those games.
A tragic loss we'd have never recovered from. It would have deprived Nintendo of what was their primary revenue stream. The Game Boy, really, its lifespan can be sort of divided in this sort of pre-Pokemon, post-Pokemon era. You see a lot of game complexity pick up after the Pokemon comes out. You see a lot more publishers pushing relatively complicated, you know, games on there. You see a lot more licensed titles that aren't just, oh, what's a good example? Just aren't, like, just really bad platformers where you collect coins or whatever.
The advancement of puns also was greatly boosted.
No. but it provided them a revenue stream for their handhelds that essentially was beating out their console business well up until the Wii came out. And I don't know if the Wii and DS ever actually crossed lines, but it put them in a position that they were able to deal with whatever competitors came into that marketplace and ultimately made them a lot of money. And discussing what the long-term effect on their bottom line and their fiscal health would be is kind of dull for this audience, so it's probably not worth going into, and it would be incredibly speculative. Yes, but it made them a lot of money and ultimately helped them continue on through the dark times of the N64 era.
Yeah. All right, Nate, what about you?
You know, depending on who might have picked it up if Nintendo had passed, I think, I don't know. Well, Nintendo kind of keeps it in kind of a safe middle ground. They don't really exploit the series, but they keep it in a pretty regular state, you know, with
iteration.
There's
a Pokemon lounge down the hall. You want to continue to state they don't exploit the series?
Well, I mean, they don't exploit it on, like, a...
Jared may be making some commentary with his selections.
What's wrong with Pokemon Snap?
Go to your Blockbuster and print off stickers.
This is probably my favorite Pokemon game right here.
But just in the way that they put out the same kind of, you know, two-pack every year and then a third but they don't make it into like an overly saturated franchise.
Mm. Yeah. For my part, I think, actually, I'm glad Jared's showing this because it gets right to my thought on this, which is that if Pokemon had not come out in America, it would have made N64 a lot worse off in America. It's easy to forget now, but in 1999 and 2000, the Pokemon games were among the best-selling, in fact, some of the only good-selling N64 games in the West. And games like Pokemon Snap, maybe not quite as much, but Pokemon Stadium was a massive hit in America, even the... You know, even the early versions that didn't even support all the Pokemon, and then the Gold and Silver version was huge too in 2000. So, I think this would have been pretty significant on them. The other little aspect of it, I think, is that if Pokemon had not come out and become as popular as it has in the West, we probably wouldn't be getting Dragon Quest games anymore. And maybe not many people really care about that, but I do. if you think about where the series was, we missed all the Super NES Dragon Quest games. None of them were released in America until much later on DS. And Dragon Quest VII, which came out in 99, I think, on PS1 in North America. No, it was 2000 in North America. It was a massive flop. And that very well could have been the last Dragon Quest game ever released. But instead what happened is Pokemon became huge. And Enix, although eventually to become Square Enix, but at the time just Enix, started re-releasing Dragon Quest 1 and 2, Dragon Quest 3, and Dragon Quest 4 for the Game Boy Color. And they did surprisingly well, I think. And partly because there was this built-in audience of Pokemon fans who found the game very similar and very accessible. And I think to this day, you know, every time a Dragon Quest game comes out, I think the base Pokemon gods for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit it. At the time, in the mid-90s in the U.S., the role-playing game genre was dead.
Those graphics.
I mean, it was nice.
It's a TI-86.
So the role-playing game genre was not... It was a total non-starter. I mean, it was considered, you know, it was very, very popular in Japan, but had just never, even after, I mean, companies like, you know, Square and Enix had invested, and Nintendo, you know, I mean, had tried to get American players to pick up role-playing games outside of the niche fan base, they weren't able to do it. And so that was the strike against the Pokemon games. You know, had there been any other genre of game, I think it would have been a foregone conclusion, of course, release them in the U.S. That was probably the thing that would have held them back. And had Nintendo made the decision to not release the Pokemon games in the U.S., it would have been based not on the fact that they didn't think they were marketable, but that maybe they felt that the genre of game was too Japanese and too difficult to... and not only just to get gamers to play it in the U.S., but to get small children to play it, because the people who were playing role-playing games were adults, you know, were teens and adults, and this was really marketed to kids. But the answer to what would have happened had Nintendo not released Pokemon Red and Blue in the U.S. is that it would have released Pokemon Gold and Silver in the U.S. because by the time that those games came out and the series was really, really chugging along and doing extremely well in Japan and becoming not just a video game series but this national absolute phenomenon, Nintendo would not have left that money on the table. They would have said, okay, let's translate Pokemon Gold and Silver and bring them out and see how they do in the U.S.
Yeah. I think ultimately the lesson Nintendo learned back in 1998, especially well into 99, is that Pokemon worked in America not in spite of its complexity, but because of its complexity. Because they were marketing it to children, it made children feel smart that they could figure out how to play it, and it gave them these, I mean, literally systems of like 15 by 15 tables, you know, these massive wall charts that kids had on all the different weaknesses and strengths. And it gave them something to chew on, something to discuss. It gave them a secret code that they could argue about amongst themselves, and you know, and it gave them something that their parents really didn't understand. Mm-hmm. It gave them that secret language, and this, you know, you can go back to pop culture a long time. This is very valuable to children. But ultimately, I think that's why it worked, is because it is actually a pretty sophisticated Japanese RPG, and it was something that they hadn't really tried marketing to that audience before. So the last thing we're going to do before Q&A, although that's coming up very, very shortly here. is thought that we would do some quick elevator pitches. So as we all know, Nintendo is in not the best position right now. They're having some trouble with Wii U, and their financial reports have been somewhat lackluster the past couple of years. Their investors are maybe revolting. And so being that they have come from a position of such strength a few years ago with Wii and DS, and now they're currently, I'm not saying they're in a really bad place, but they're in a much less good place, thought that we would do some quick ideas for how Nintendo might either save themselves, or if you don't think they need to be saved, maybe just improve their situation right now. And I'll go first to kind of give you an idea of it. So these will be very short, but the idea here is that if you were trapped in an elevator with the CEO and you had like 60 seconds
trapped in an elevator,
not
with
trapped,
the water.
But if you're in the
it's
in the
stuck
elevator
between the third and fifth floor,
yes,
it could be the fourth floor, but it's stuck anyway.
Yeah,
you wouldn't.
And he's trying to do a Nintendo Direct, and you need to stop him.
He'd start ripping things off the wall and putting them on his head. But if you had a chance to talk to Mr. Iwata for just a few minutes, what would you try to get him to do? What idea would you provide? So here's mine, and I'll go first because it's probably the worst idea. I think
is it Pokemon Snap on Wii U?
Done.
No.
Company saved.
I would love that. But actually, I think Nintendo should release Nintendo DS games on the eShop for 3DS.
Ooh.
The reason being, this is very different from the stuff they're doing with Virtual Console, because you don't have to emulate Nintendo DS games. The 3DS plays them natively. So you should be able to bring in lots and lots and lots of Nintendo DS games with very little testing. You really shouldn't have any major technical problems. As long as you build a system that loads the ROM into the memory, then the system will play them perfectly, just like it does if you had the cartridge in there. I think there's probably a really big market for this, and because the DS is the most successful system ever released, there are many, many games that people would like. For Nintendo's first-party games, it's pure profit. Anything they want to sell, anything that they can sell on there, they can make a lot of money in the short term. I think for third parties, it might also be very attractive, because a lot of third parties had pretty successful games on 3D on DS as well, and giving them an opportunity to enter back into the 3DS marketplace, I think gives them a chance to maybe pull some people back in.
Well, not that game.
No. That game, A, has been replaced, and B...
It's awfully cute, though.
Oh.
That's Nintendogs. But I think it
no,
might give...
It
I think
is?
It. That was for the podcast.
Disagree.
That was for the podcast listeners who can't see
agents.
It. But I think it might give third parties a chance to get introduced to the 3DS platform, some of those who have left and gone and focused more on PSP and Vita games.
iPhone games, really.
So yeah, that's basically it. And I think they should release them in big chunks, maybe like 10 games at a time, so that everyone will have at least, every time they release games, there's at least one of them that you want. Whereas this trickle with Virtual Console, the problem is sometimes you might go months with not having anything you're interested in, and by then they've totally lost you.
Atlas thinks that's a wonderful idea, but the six people who own Radiant Historia hate you right now.
So, Nate, why don't you go next?
Well, I will agree with your point and then add that I would like to see some sort of cross-buy initiative, kind of like PSN, just something that would take the features of both the 3DS and the Wii U and make them worth owning together.
Like with Monster Hunter?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Just anything that can, hitch the Wii U to the success of the 3DS.
Yeah. I think the problem there is you might give consumers the feeling that they have to own both versions to really have the full experience, and then you've kind of increased the barrier of entry for some people.
Sure.
But those who want to get it anyway, you might sell them two games instead of one. So maybe it all balances out.
Monster Hunter fans will do that anyway. It's fine. They'll buy. This is the same game, by the way, in case you've forgotten. They'll buy it again. Don't worry.
So, Guillaume, what about you?
Well... Handhelds haven't really had much Western support historically, and the 3DS probably less than ever. And a lot of things that you hear about are that from indie developers is that you can just right away start programming for iOS and the PC, but you have to get an expensive development kit if you want to develop something for the consoles. So perhaps try to work better with indie developers, because there is not really, more and more you see the medium-sized developers who would traditionally make handheld games disappear. So you can't count on them anymore, obviously. So court indies and perhaps give away development kits. And so that's for the handhelds. For the Wii U, the same probably applies. like just make it as easy as possible to port games to the Wii U. And I think if the games come, then the like people will follow.
Yeah. I think the small developer support is much better on Wii U. It hasn't fully come to fruition yet in terms of what games are available on the eShop, but it's getting there. And everything we hear from developers is that the Wii U is much, much easier to work for, and Nintendo's done a lot to refine their systems so that it's easier for smaller developers to support it.
Yeah, it's very strange, though, because you don't really hear... Like, you hear that on the Wii U, on the eShop, developers can decide to do a sale by themselves, you know? And you don't hear that about the 3DS.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's blocking them here?
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
I believe they have that power on Wii U, but not necessarily on 3DS. I mean, you know, so... I mean, one of the most successful iOS games was made by Zach Gage, right? Spell Tower. Not one of the most successful iOS games, but of the last year, one of the sort of breakout indie hits that, you know, was done by this one guy, made him a bunch of money, people love it, and he made it in his house. He made it in his apartment in Manhattan. And he couldn't have been able to do that on the Nintendo 3DS. And I know for a fact this guy loves Nintendo. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of the indie developers that are working today, if you look at the games they're making, so many of those games are just inspired by a Nintendo aesthetic. These are kids of the NES, SNES, and even N64 era grown up making video games, but they're doing it on iOS, not because they don't like buttons or Nintendo platforms, but because that is where they can make games and publish games and see them out there. And even, I mean, there's people making games who don't even care if they make money. They just want to make a cool game and be able to tell their friends, like, oh, I made a cool game. You can download it onto your iPhone. So part of my answer would be to say, Nintendo, if it's not working on it already, absolutely must develop some kind of platform or a way that... The difference between the 3DS and, like, the iPhone is if I want to make an iPhone game, it is assumed that I will be able to just publish it on the store, set whatever price I want, and do it without any... I mean, there's a minimal amount of oversight where it's like, you know, Apple has a couple of guidelines of you can't do this, but you publish the game and then they would, you know, reject it or take it off the store. But with Nintendo, it's like hoop after hoop after hoop after hoop that you have to jump through. And one of them was, for a long time, and I think they just finally just changed this, is that you could not be a developer unless you, like, have an office.
Yes.
But it's also you have to have, like, a continuing revenue stream already to pay for that office, you know? So it totally, the person with a great game idea can't make a game. So they've got to have something of an indie games channel where they just let anybody put games. And this is a big step for Nintendo. If they're not quite willing to take that step yet, and they will have to, this is not Nintendo versus Apple or Nintendo versus Sony. This is just Nintendo versus straight up reality. Eventually, I guarantee you, Nintendo will do this. It's just a matter of time. But if they're not ready for that yet, they really should be looking at, like, you know, as many games as possible everywhere. It really should be, as you said, like, I mean, not just DS games on the eShop, but if they can make it work, if they have the licenses worked out, get those games on there ASAP, because people are not, they're not going and buying cartridges anymore. Fire Emblem on the 3DS, Nintendo's digital delivery service for 3DS utterly sucks. It's the worst, right? I mean, it's so hard to use. Nobody knows the eShop is there. It takes so long to download games. The download copies are so expensive. They're the same price as retail. Everything about it is bad. It's not as bad as it was on the DS, but it's still just a bad experience, right? Even with the experience being that bad, the percentage of copies of Fire Emblem that they sold, digital versus physical, was phenomenal. They sold a huge number of digital delivery versions of Fire Emblem on 3DS, which shows that the people who are buying 3DS are more used to, you know, getting games digitally. And if they push it a little bit more,
it might have more to do with the people who are interested in buying Fire Emblem.
Sure,
know what the eShop is.
Yeah,
that may not be the case for all games.
But it was still a large number of software titles. So if people are using the eShop, it's like, okay, NES, Super Nintendo, you know, Game Boy Advance, everything under the sun. Get those games. Don't trickle them out one freaking game a week, you know? Like, get as many games as humanly possible onto the service. Make it very, very easy for third parties who are just sitting on all of these DS games, who are sitting on all of these Game Boy Advance games that they used to sell, that they have the rights to and that they would sell again. Make it easy for them to get those things onto the shop, you know, very, very cheaply, and load up the store to the point where you can browse and you can window shop and you can impulse buy things, you know? Like, people are moving towards that. Nobody wants to carry around a baggie of video games anymore with them with their portable system. Like, I just want it all on an SD card. I want smaller games. I want cheaper games. And the library is there. They don't have to develop the games. I would buy Elite Beat Agents again on every one of my 3DSs just to make the point, you know?
You want the, you know, just like an iPod carries all of your music in your pocket.
Yeah.
You want the 3DS to hold all of your portable
games.
Why
can't the 3DS be my ultimate portable Nintendo device? I mean, I'm sure somebody's already hacked the 3DS and put every NES ROM on it. So why isn't Nintendo, like, making money off of that if we're talking about saving Nintendo?
Yep.
And let's allow people to make a playlist of their games, just like they would have a playlist on their iPods.
That would be useful for you, wouldn't it?
Just go through game after game after
just
game.
Just call it the backlog app. So we've got one more for James, and while James is giving his pitch, why don't we go ahead and line up for Q&A?
So mine sort of goes back into this. We've discussed it on the show before, but it's more of a business end decision that they need to go ahead and evaluate. The difficulty with getting a platform started, especially at this point where they're sort of in this middle area where they're getting a lot of these ports right now of games that are already out on other systems for multiple years. They really need to be sort of the spot of first delivery where these games come out. And it goes back to what we just discussed with Fire Emblem, where they sold, I think it was 30% of their sales were digital, which is, if you could think about it, the cost of producing a game and moving it to a location is relatively high. But a digital copy literally has no cost. It is a thing that sits on a server and you download it. They pay their bandwidth provider. So from Nintendo's standpoint, the amount they collect, because they produce the cartridges and the discs for the publishers, the amount they collect for that, they don't need to collect on a digital sale. So to me, it seems like if they were to negotiate deals with publishers that says, you know, we'll take a relatively small cut of it to make profit and enough to cover our ambassador program, and you all just get everything else, that would be a much more incentive to publishers and saying, look, we've sold some Wii U units this week. It's getting better, guys. We told them that you wouldn't have to sell as many games to make up money. That's really one of the big draws of putting out these small games on portable devices. We heard it yesterday talking to, who were we talking to at that point?
On portable devices?
Yeah, they were talking about the fact that you could, the reason that it was easy to go to iOS was that you only had to sell, to Vita was you only had to sell a really small number of copies to be profitable.
That was the Dragon Fantasy 2 guys.
Yeah, it was a mind-bogglingly small number. It was in less than 10,000, and they said we'd clear profit on this version. If you could put a situation like that for larger titles on your console, they're going to release, even if they have to do a port down, because that makes it really easy for them, because they can say, we have a guaranteed profit stream on this system, even if it's relatively minor. And that makes games on your system, and that makes your system a viable entrant into the field.
All right. So it's time for questions and answers. You, sir, please go first.
Hi, my name is Matt. I'm from Massachusetts. Longtime Nintendo fan, and one thing that I think maybe across the board, not just Nintendo, but I think marketing has become a challenge for these companies. And just wondering, what do you think Nintendo could do to kind of recapture the old days of kind of marketing, of viral marketing? They used to put really cool things in magazines that were hints of upcoming things, but it's changed.
What's a magazine?
Exactly. Well, so I was just wondering what your impressions of the marketing on the Wii U, for example, what they could do to make it more exciting for people to get them excited about the
Sure. Yeah, it's a very good question. And the commercials, Explosions. The Wii U commercial that Jared is putting up on the screen right now is, I think, very indicative of the problem that they have, because they made a big deal out of when this commercial was first released, and they had a few people talking about it. The problem is people don't watch TV anymore. They don't watch TV with commercials. And so you can spend a lot of money to produce this very expensive, very snazzy, you know, kind of Hollywood Squares commercial.
What is this?
But But frankly,
this never happens.
It doesn't matter how good your TV commercial is. No one's going to care.
Oh my God,
this is not something that people are going to share around online and say, hey, you got to check out this new Wii U commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, come on. Nobody's going to do that. It's not a movie trailer. So what Nintendo has to do is to get gamers, and not just gamers, but people who play video games of any to any degree, they need to get them telling each other about these systems. And they have to find ways to generate these conversations. And I don't think producing expensive TV commercials is the way to do it.
Twitter bots, obviously.
Hashtags.
Yeah. Marketing is telling a story, right? I mean, it's conveying a message to people, you know, getting that message across of like, this is what this is what it's for, this is why you want it. The Wii U right now is, if it were a story, it's like Ulysses, you know what I mean? It's confusing, and what Nintendo needs to do is have a more direct, like, with the Wii, it was so simple, you know what I mean? Like, as soon as you saw somebody pick up a Wii controller and go, and hit a tennis ball, that was it. You know, that was all they needed to do. I think that Nintendo might actually have an opportunity, if it does it correctly, with Wii Fit U, which it delayed. You know, it was going to bring it out in the launch window, and they seemed to just be like, oh, you know, it'll use the balance board, but you can use the Wii, you know, gamepad. What I hope it has done is delayed it so that they can, like, you know, I don't know what it is. Is it like, is it hire a famous, you know, fitness trainer to put their face in the box? You know, is it really kind of like trying to, is it, you know, are they making, are they going to partner with Nike and let you use your Nike Fuel Band, which is so hot right now, to like, you know, upload your data to the Wii Fit U? Because right now, you know, technological, you know, ways of getting fit are huge. And if it can position that product as like, this is the cool new thing. Yeah, sit on your butt and play. Yeah. If they can position this product as like the cool new way to get fit again, you know, and show like, then they can really get that mainstream audience back in there buying Wii U. So it's really about redefining what the Wii U is, because right now defining the Wii U with, are we just going to keep showing video
this
guy playing a game with his ass?
This is vital.
So, yeah, I think I don't know that Wii Fit is the game to do it, quite possibly. But what I think Nintendo needs to do is release a Wii U game that sort of crystallizes what makes it different and unique, and then market the heck out of that game. Because the problem right now is that the story of what Wii U does and why it's cool is so complicated that they can't summarize it to people who aren't previously familiar with the platform. And they've got to, and the big problem is they don't have the game, because Nintendo Land is just this multi-headed hydra of gameplay styles. It's very confusing to explain to people, and Mario looks like every other Mario game. Those are the two first-party games they've released so far. Mm. That's a big problem. So they need to release a game that actually is the Wii Sports, or is whatever you want to call it, but it has to be the game that they're really going to get behind, and that just makes sense when you look at it. And it shows people that they can do something cool with the system that they've never done before, and that they really want to do. And they have not done that. That's a huge failure on their part so far. But, you know, E3 is, they've announced zero games past E3, other than an HD remake of Zelda. So they have a long way to go.
No. They're making another Zelda game. They are.
Yes.
Hey, guys. This is John from Kansas City.
Hey, man.
Glad to see you guys back. Glad to see James didn't have a black eye.
I didn't fall this time.
That's good. I guess, since you mentioned game announcements, I think I'd like to hear you guys' thoughts on kind of the black sheep of video games, movie games. I think we've always discussed, at least amongst my friends, the movies that we thought would make a really good video game. And I was just curious, because it really hasn't been done too well at all. What movies do you think would make a good video game, and how to approach it?
Nick Cage in Where's Waldo NES. Done. Out. We're finished.
Die Hard cross Shadow Complex.
Hey, I like that. That's really good.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah.
Are we doing this seriously?
Sure. My favorite movie is The Big Lebowski, which probably would not translate very well. But I tell you,
bowling.
My second favorite movie is 2001: A Space Odyssey, and I think there's actually another movie maybe that's going to be similar called Gravity coming out at the end of this year. It's from Alfonso Cuarón, I think, and. It's a movie where the entire movie is a spacewalk, and there was a game that was announced a few years ago, never came out, that Nintendo was creating in Japan about spacewalking. And I think, I don't know that, you know, tying it to a movie necessarily is the way to go, but I think that's a really interesting mechanic that has never been done very much. The best probably example is in the Dead Space series, which is also not on Nintendo consoles in that way. But I think it's a really cool way to play a game and to create objectives around that and to make it interesting is something that I feel like Nintendo is probably equipped to do. So, I don't know. It's not a direct answer to your question, but it's something I'd like to see.
I would say let go of this fantasy that it's possible to make a good movie game. I mean, it's when you start with a pre-written idea of the story and the world and all of that, you're doing it backwards. The way to make a great game is you start with the gameplay and then you ask yourself, okay, well, I've got a good gameplay, you know, mechanic here. What sort of story and world is suggested by that, you know, which is why when you do it the other way, you get, it's like The Legend of Zelda versus Advent Rising, you know, where you get people to sit down and like write a whole gigantic world with a story Bible and all this stuff before they design bit one of the gameplay. And nobody remembers any of that stuff, but everybody remembers the story to Zelda because it grew up organically out of the fundamental gameplay mechanic. And so it's never going to work.
Well, they could also take a page from Capcom, that trailblazing series developer, and just release Super Mario the Movie, the game. Mm. Something I've always wanted to see. Maybe Bob Hoskins has better things to do, though. I don't know.
All right. Thanks, man.
Can we get the Street Fighter movie game up there?
Okay. Hi, guys. My name is Louis from Quebec City. I've got a question about, well, when I was 7 years old, I had my first console. It was a brand new Atari 2600, you know, with the little fake wood in it. And back then, I was really happy, but I lived like the little crisis about the quality of games. And then came the Nintendo seal of approval in games. And I was wondering if you think that maybe the problem with indie games is that, you know, Nintendo, have a problem with, like, the quality control of the games, or could be a reason, or
That's it, yeah. I mean, they want to absolutely exercise that level of, like, oversight and quality control and reviewing every single thing, because they're very protective of their own brand image. But it's like when you play a crappy iPhone game and you're like, oh, that's the crappiest iPhone game ever, do you think, wow, Apple is a bad company, or like Apple makes bad products because I just played a bad 99-cent iOS game? No. So it's just a question of disassociating that, the strength of your brand. Now, this is easier said than done, right? Like, but you know, it's a question of making sure that people understand what is the Nintendo product and what is something else. If you watch a bad movie on DVD, you don't look at the maker of your DVD player and go, you know, F you, Panasonic. Snakes on a Plane is terrible, you know?
I think the seal of quality, though, really, all it means at this point is that, yes, this is an officially licensed product. Because, I mean,
that's all it's ever meant.
Yeah, but it implies so much more. I mean, everybody on this panel has reviewed a game that is so atrocious it makes you question continuing to live, I would imagine. And the seal of quality was there. It didn't mean a damn thing at that point, because you just felt like, I know.
Well, and the idea of the seal of quality is it means that Nintendo has lot-checked the game, and they've made sure that it has no massive bugs, that it won't break your system, that it won't corrupt your hard drive, etc. And I think even that doesn't really mean anything. In the modern day, you've got games like Sonic and All-Star Racing Transformed that comes out really broken. Like, major parts of the game do not work at all, and it freezes constantly, and it makes you think, oh my god, my system's broken, when actually it's just you need to unplug it and plug it back in, even though they tell you not to do that. I mean, these are real problems, and these games are actually coming out. Thankfully, that one got patched and turned out to be really fun. But, you know, the days of games being bug tested, you know, perfectly, just, they've never really existed, but it's getting worse because games are getting more complicated. So I think Chris is right. This is a hang-up that they kind of need to let go of.
Just Sonic and All-Stars Racing was borked like that because they had the online was added like the day the damn system came out, if we all remember, and that's what killed it all.
Yeah.
Well, Sega's inability to do anything is...
Yeah, that's actually...
Beyond the scope of this podcast.
Not even here.
These are things we have written about.
That's for another
That
panel.
Is a company who can't do anything right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Hello, I'm Alex from New Jersey. And one thing that Nintendo is different than the other two lead manufacturers seems to be is their separation of countries, so to speak. That Nintendo Japan kind of runs the whole show, whereas Sony seems to have an American branch and a European branch, and even Microsoft had its Japanese branch for whatever non-existent time it had it. But
I don't know they would have qualified to like for a Nintendo developer license, actually.
Yeah,
there might have been an office.
But the fact is that, you know, some people see Nintendo of America as just nothing more than a marketing company. It doesn't even see it as even any influence whatsoever. Same thing even happened in Europe. It doesn't even seem to exist. It just has all these little marketing companies scattered throughout Europe. So what do you think that Nintendo of Japan could benefit from having given some more rights and power to Nintendo of America and Europe and to actually, you know, develop games on their end as opposed to being stared over the shoulder the whole time?
I think they should franchise on a state-by-state basis.
Yeah. Ooh. I think Nintendo of New Jersey is going to be a disaster.
Mm. Actually, the franchise model gets to the heart of this question, which is that Nintendo Company Limited in Japan, they want control. Mm-hmm. They want the consistency from one region to another. Even though not all the same games come out, the idea is that the way that they treat people and the way that they release products has a similar level of quality everywhere. And again, it's something that I think they have given up a little bit over time. I think Reggie Fils-Aimé in Nintendo of America has been somewhat forceful in getting a little bit more autonomy, but still, relatively speaking, not that much. And I can tell you we have intimate experience with this, having, you know, tried to work with Nintendo of America for over a decade now. A lot of times we just get told, can't do that because Japan says no. And they are really, really driven by that. And then the people who work for Nintendo of America, like their PR agencies, are even more powerless because there are two or three layers of people above them who've just said, nah. And it's a real problem. And, you know, I think there are potential pratfalls with Japan giving more control to these different regions. But I think the benefits probably outweigh it in the long run. So there are ways to give oversight without having quite so much control.
It should be noted that for example, Nintendo and Sony are actually set up differently in this regard. Nintendo of America is a marketing company for Nintendo of Japan. Now, they do other... I mean, you know, as Nintendo of Japan has had games developed in America, obviously there's, you know, they would interface with NOA, like Luigi's Mansion. Luigi's Mansion, Dark Moon, on sale right now in the Nintendo booth, is developed by Next Level Games in Vancouver, so obviously Nintendo of America has some people there doing that. But primarily, Nintendo, you know, NCL decides who makes the products, and it is Nintendo of America's job to market them. Sony, on the other hand, when it was originally set up, there's Sony Computer Entertainment, and then underneath Sony Computer Entertainment in general, there was Sony Computer Entertainment America and Sony Computer Entertainment Japan.
And they're equals.
And they're equals. They're you know, equal on the org chart. That one is not over the other. And so that is why Sony Computer Entertainment America was like, okay, but we have the PlayStation and we can just do whatever we want with it. And so that's why by 2005, you know, Sony was making God of War and Nintendo of America was making, like, Geist, you know? Like, that's, I hate to say it, but, you know, they were really able to develop, like, really, really excellent, a lot of excellent homegrown content. Should Nintendo have done that? Yes. Should they do it now? Yes. Makes no sense to not do it.
To be fair, Geist was in development since about 2001.
Which is always a sign of quality,
actually.
It just took a long time.
4 years for a game that takes 10 hours to beat is a pretty strong indication.
Yeah.
That's 2 hours a year.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, everybody. Hey. Adam from Boston. Just wanted to let
everybody
know.
Where's that?
I grew up a Sega freak, so I'm a Sega guy, but after they went downhill, I kind of had to come over to Nintendo. One thing that Sega, I think, did well, at least in the 90s and 2000s, is their creativity with their games. And that's why a lot of people are really hardcore right now. And when I, about Sega, and when I saw the new games coming out this year for Nintendo, I was kind of depressed because it's just sequel after sequel after sequel. And I loved the originals, and I loved the first couple of sequels, but now I'm really getting bored of it. Can you just kind of address this IP crisis, I think, that maybe Nintendo is having?
I mean, it's really part of a larger issue for the industry right now. There's... Oh, okay, I thought he was going to bring up something really that we've had about three sequels of in the last week. No, he went creative on me. We're good. The if you look at the general tenor of marketing right now, larger games tend to be sequels because companies are more or less risk-averse. It's incredibly expensive to produce a big title, and you don't want to go out on a limb to do it because what if you lose all that money? You could go bankrupt. And there's a certain aversion to doing things that are new. Nintendo's had that aversion longer than most, I think. But it is kind of a weird place that Sega was in. I feel like maybe they were more willing to just do stuff because they were already there. And we're like, well, we don't have much to go on besides make more Sonic games. I don't know how they get around that, though, short of producing these smaller games and just seeing what sticks.
To me, the problem with Nintendo is not a lack of creativity. It's a branding issue because a lot of times the sequels that we might look on the face of and say, yeah, I know you're making a new Mario Kart, but I may not be interested if I assume that it's just like the last one. When they have gone out and done more radical things like with Double Dash on GameCube, that's a pretty different Mario Kart. It plays totally differently in the end. And it ends up being a love it or hate it thing. I love it, but at least it's different. And so if you have the expectation that even within a franchise, they're going to continue to innovate and do something really drastic, you know, like Skyward Sword is just another Zelda game, and yet it's totally different and really crazy. It's not really like anything else you've ever played before. I think they need to focus on that stuff a little more. But for the reasons that James pointed out, they want you to have a level of familiarity, and they're very reticent to introduce new characters and new worlds. With Pikmin 3 coming out, it's a game, if you've played it on the show floor, that demo's from E3 last year. So I don't necessarily think it's very indicative of what the final product will be. And Pikmin has been gone for over 10 years. So I'm really hoping they're going to do something very different and new and exciting with Pikmin, because if it's just Pikmin 2 in HD, I may not even buy it. I mean, I think that's really... And I love Pikmin. I want to play more of it, but I want them to do something fresh with it. And I think they have the capacity to do that, but they need to tell people about it. You know, they need to really focus on those features rather than, hey, Pikmin's back. You know, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't keep giving people the things that they've had before and expect them to love it, because eventually they'll get bored.
I think that Nintendo is actually doing more with new IP than you guys are giving them credit for, because you're not looking at... They're introducing them as downloadable titles. They've done stuff like Sakura Samurai or whatever it was called
Pushmo.
In the U.S. Pushmo and Dylan's Rolling Western, and actually coming out really soon, another plug, is Harmonite, which is a brilliant, really, really, really fun side-scrolling rhythm game from Game Freak, who developed Pokemon. So much fun. And this is the kind of game, it's not just a little downloadable game. It's really hitting that middle section where this is the sort of thing you would have paid like $30 for on the Game Boy Advance, you know, back in those great creative days when people were pushing out a lot of stuff. So
now you're going to pay $30 for it on the eShop.
15. It does cost a little bit for a downloadable game, but it's not just a simple little thing. It is a lengthy, very, very long and deep and fun experience. And it's great. I think they are doing new IP.
I think they need to market this stuff better. Because, I mean, right now, all I've heard from Harmonite, at least from Nintendo, is three press releases, one of which drones on for about 100,000 words too long, and one of them had a screenshot attached.
There's a demo.
There is a demo, but they don't really... But that even that was just mentioned in a press release.
Yeah. It's not the easiest thing to find. We actually have to end the panel. Sorry, guys. Our time is up. So I apologize. We are going to be hanging out outside in the hallway. So if you didn't get a chance to ask your question, please come talk to us. Or if you just want to say hello, we'll be around. And before we go, I want to say big thanks to our friend Chris Kohler here.
Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure.
I appreciate
it. I'm glad we could finally do that. Nate Andrews as well. Really appreciate you being here. Of course, you can hear Guillaume and James, myself, and our not-present friend John Lindemann every week on the podcast. I hope you'll check that out, Radio Free Nintendo. It's on iTunes, or just do a Google search. It's at our website, Nintendo World Report. Quick plug, tomorrow, same time, same place, we'll have a panel for Who Wants to Be a Nintendo Heir. All these guys in the front row up here are going to be running it. It's really, really fun, and you and the audience can come up and participate and win prizes. So it's going to be really fun. I hope you will come to that. Also, before I forget, Mr. Jared Rosenberg over there running the video for us. Did a great job. And as always, thank you to PAX East and to the Enforcers for letting us do this. And thank you all for coming.
I have a plug. I should plug. We're doing Retro Game Roadshow, which is like Antiques Roadshow, but for video games, in the Naga Theater at, I believe, 8:30 p.m. this evening. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Hello Kitty World will be there, as well as we'll have other audience members bring up their collectible games. So do come to that.
It's
great.
Always one of the best panels at PAX. Aww. If you haven't been to it, you really, really should.
What
it's
is
awesome.
The going rate for Hello Kitty World? Just curiosity.
Nah, I don't know. Probably $10 on it. Oh. It's not rare.
All right. Thank you, guys.